They say that hindsight is 20/20. All too often, it's about things that look obvious to us in retrospect. The implication is, yes, we should learn from our mistakes, but seeing them too late to avoid them the first time is nothing to brag about. Don't overthink this, though. 20/20 implies good vision because people with that rating for visual acuity don't need glasses for everyday activities like driving. In fact, it's only a measure of average vision at 20 feet of fixed objects. With 20/20 vision, you can see things that are 20 feet away about as well as the average person. And it says nothing about whether you might need reading glasses for things that are close up, about your color vision, your peripheral vision, your depth perception, your tracking ability. Good luck hitting major league pitching with only 20/20 vision. The truth is that we could use something much better than 20/20 vision when it comes to hindsight. To be sure, the actual events are firmly embedded in time, but our information about them often isn't. What caused them? How they influenced each other? What lessons they offer us? That's constantly being reinterpreted, if it's being remembered at all. And of course, the past continues to influence the present and the future. What is obvious in hindsight today may not stand the test of time. As the writer William Faulkner famously said, the past isn't over, it isn't even past. I tear up when I hear the circle game, more so, I confess, with each passing year. And I don't think I was the only one in the room with that experience as we played that song. I think it's because I'm getting better at hindsight with age. As Joni Mitchell sang, we're captive on the carousel of time. We can't return. We can only look behind from where we came. But that's not the whole truth. We gather here because Unitarian Universalism and beloved community sharpen our hindsight on the whetstone of love. Like the former Mother Jones reporter turned Christian social activist Sarah Miles said, religion is not so much about swallowing beliefs as it is learning to see. And that's learning to see in every direction. I got a strong prompt for this reflection in December when a New York Times reporter messaged the Times alumni Facebook page seeking memories of the New Year's Eve that brought us the year 2000. Y2K. My mind immediately turned to a beloved cousin who sadly died young in 2010 while I was in seminary. Andrea had four teenage and young adult children at that time, three of whom were almost exactly the same age as our children. She and Michelle were close companions through pregnancy. But I was thinking about the fall of 1987, when she had just given birth to her first child. How long will you take before going back to work? I asked her on the phone, knowing she was a well-paid computer programmer for a major insurance company. I'm not sure I will go back, she said. It's all going to be year 2000 work. What's that? I said. And she explained. Memory capacity was expensive and often in short supply on the big mainframe computers used in corporate America and government. So, to save memory, programmers used two digits to represent the year. If a program, including the birth date of Nina, her daughter, read 87, it assumed 1987. Programmers had no idea how long the mainframes or the software might be used. And for the first few decades of the computer era, their superiors didn't think to ask what would happen when all the 99s in their programs would encounter 00 on January 1st, 2000. By the late 1980s, though, some computer experts began to talk of the issue as a potentially ticking time bomb. They started running tests, and it turned out that many computers might miscalculate results, leave data fields blank, or simply freeze. With computers rapidly becoming interconnected globally, more and more machinery relying on electronic controls, and a new generation of smaller desktop computers proliferating outside of the corporate data centers, no one could confidently assess the ultimate risks. They gave the problem the name Y2K, with Y standing for year and K for kilo, the Greek word for thousand. As I started to look into it, I discovered that insurers, some banks, the Pentagon, and other computer users with really long time horizons had already begun replacing equipment and recoding software. But this was still back burner work in 1987. The spotlight was very much on new applications. That's where the payoff was. So were the financial incentives for the data managers ushering those new applications into the market. And the programmers certainly weren't pushing the issue. They found the date work tedious, and they didn't want to do it. I was fascinated. Although I'd been a technology reporter for most of my 8 years at the Times at that point, I hadn't heard or read anything about this anywhere. The following spring, the Times ran my article on the subject on the front page of the paper. It began, "The dawn of the new century may come as a shock to thousands of computers around the world. Programs that record years in two digits and know no time but the 1900s may be stymied by the year 2000. As things now stand, many computers would malfunction or miscalculate because they rely on programs that fail to recognize that the day after December 31st, 1999 is January 1st, 2000. Expert opinion differs widely about how pressing the problem is and how to address it. One great comfort to data processing executives is that many of today's problem programs, up to 80% by some estimates, will have been replaced by 1999 in the normal course of business." I went on in that story to note that few types of data are so widely used as software, in software, as dates. And over the years, the programmers had used countless methods of coding dates and signaling that there was a date coming up in the program, sometimes even just using like girlfriends' names. Many of them were so obscure that another programmer searching a program for portions dealing with dates might have trouble locating all of them. And I quoted the head of information systems at a large New York insurer who said, "It could be an absolute horror show with anyone with mainframe computers. The joke in computing circles is that every data processing manager, no matter how old they are, is saying they plan to retire early in 1999. Y2K temporarily became my full-time beat in the second half of 1998. And I had a front row seat on a worldwide technical cooperation operation, a scale never seen before. I reported the growing faith that the technical problems would be short-lived and contained to a few businesses or regions. But I also reported on the growing appreciation for the complexity and the unknowns, and on the growing hype about potential disaster, which was becoming a part of popular culture. The experts were more afraid of the destruction that could come from hoarding, increased gun sales, bank runs, and other forms of human panic than of the Y2K bugs. Managing expectations became a very tough job for the Clinton administration. There was a man named John Koskinen who was formerly called the Y2K czar, and he told me it was a really fine balancing act between keeping the pressure on the companies to keep up with the remediation and the testing and not panicking consumers. Well, some of you remember that New Year's Eve and the days that followed. It was festive and so calm on the technology front that it became commonplace to call Y2K a vastly overblown scam. But that was faulty hindsight. Hundreds of billions of dollars had been invested in remediation and contingency plans. New software had been invented to automate testing and recoding of old computer languages when it became clear, as we got into 1998 and 1999, that there weren't enough older programmers with experience in the affected coding language to do the job with just humans. The world's stock exchanges, banks, and other financial institutions had run repeated test scenarios across their networks. In some cases, they exchanged information they viewed as trade secrets or granted free licenses to use their intellectual property. The United States and Russia cooperated secretly, and in a few cases in public relations stunts aimed at reassuring people publicly, to eliminate the threat of missiles being launched by mistake. Millions of technical workers did Y2K-related work for weeks, months, and in some cases, years. And then, on New Year's Eve, they and millions of other workers required to be on duty nervously watched the first reports from Australia and Asia about the year 2000's arrival. And almost nothing happened. One data center at a major company told me later, I felt it was going to be fine by 3 a.m. when one of my engineers asked if he could switch the television to a Three Stooges movie. But the fact is, there were enough isolated problems to hint at the scope of the potential disaster if nothing had been done. Most of them were kept private because at that point it was embarrassing to admit that you were one of the people who had a problem, and because most of the bugs could be fixed within a few hours or days at most without any need for the public to find out. There was word, for instance, that the Pentagon had lost communications with a spy satellite. Took a few hours to reestablish that. It would have been different if they had lost communications with all of their satellites. The fact that the remediation work had done made a huge difference. And the value of the investments in more robust systems and contingency planning for disaster recovery later showed up again, unnoticed by the average citizen, in our responses to subsequent natural disasters and to the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Ask anybody in New York City in technical communications in those days, and they'll say that Y2K work made all the difference in how the city dealt with the 9/11 attacks. I can't help these days but think about Y2K in connection with the climate change crisis, which began to emerge in earnest at the same time, but is continuing to build rather than recede into the realm of hindsight. One of my mentors, Reverend Charles Ortman, preached on seeking a sustainable future the week before Easter in the year 2000, drawing on a powerful call to action by Ed Ayers of the World Watch Institute. The book was called, Ayers' book was called God's Last Offer. And its outline of the four human drivers of future climate disaster could have been written this week. The first was spiking carbon dioxide buildup in the atmosphere. The second, a sharp rise in extinction of other living species. The third he named was rising global consumption of vital resources and related increases in the production of toxic waste. And the fourth thing he named was the continued growth in population. The only differences in what he wrote then and what we would write now is that if the book was written this week, all of the supporting data would be scarier. Looking back, we can ask how the two challenges of Y2K and climate change are essentially different. That has a lot to do with how one was overcome, with benefits that added to our resiliency by global cooperation, while the other has seemingly only deepened and worsened. But we also need to ask, I think, whether humans are essentially different when confronted with such different problems. Are we fundamentally less capable of doing what needs to be done without a near-term deadline that everybody agrees on? I'm especially struck by the repeated call to panic by one of the world's currently best-known climate activists, Greta Thunberg. It stands in such stark contrast to the ultimately effective focus of the Y2K leaders, who repeatedly distinguish between an effective sense of alarm and panic. But perhaps the possibility of that nuance is what comes with a near-term deadline. With a deadline, you get a clear sense of what can plausibly be done and what contingency planning for the rest needs to look like. That, I believe, may be the reason we require specific mandates for maintaining our goals and mechanisms for enforcing them, the kind of legislation that will be before the Vermont legislature this year, for instance, even as we remain humble enough to know they will in some respect turn out to be misguided and will require updating. In hindsight, we know we didn't fully solve the Y2K problem. We did enough to minimize its impacts. We learned some things about who we were, and we kicked some problems down the road. This is going to happen on climate change. We will reduce its impact. The only question is how much and how humanely. If we fail, Earth will visit enough destruction on us that we will reduce our impact through steep population declines driven by war, disease, and famine. But we will reduce our impact. We will learn about who we are, and we will kick some important problems down the road. Now, all of this will happen in a world we inhabit collectively. But much of what will stand out for us in hindsight will be locked inside highly personal memories and images, like the imagined cans of song sparrow, brook babble, and cricket drone in Caitlin's poem. When I look back on Y2K, I think about everything I just shared with you about the actual events, but I think even more of Andrea, who saw it coming, but not the cancer that arrived in the first decade of the new millennium. The computers survived until they could be replaced. She hung on with the help of a wonderful husband long enough to almost finish raising 4 amazing children, but she was irreplaceable. In our search for truth and meaning, let us never forget that we are here to help each other liberate our better angels in the response to global problems, but no less so to comfort each other in the most private of tragedies. Only in hindsight will we see all of what we were called to do through eyes whose acuity is measured by our capacity to love. Blessed be.